Welcome to the Underclass Podcast with Austin Picard. I'm an independent researcher who can't stomach being lied to on a daily basis by the mainstream media. While we live in a fracturing society, launched into parallel realities, falling perfectly onto the two sides of the political spectrum, I remain in the underclass.
The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused. The third explosive that was found, and they are working on right now as we speak, I understand, both the second and third explosives, if you can imagine this, were larger than the first.
That they have found a second explosive device of some kind inside this building.
Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found.
One device was deactivated. Apparently there's another device.
That in fact two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
A second bomb was found on the east side of that building. A bomb squad is on the scene.
The medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area.
Well, I just took a look down the street at the Morrow building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about.
I went to a two-year graduate program, 8 quarters of armament engineering graduates, the first course that was ever set up. And after that, I worked at the Ballistic Research Laboratories at Aberdeen, which was 2 years of hands-on work designing, developing continuous rod warheads for the Blue Mark missile and other weapon systems. Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. It clearly had some what you call Broussant's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussant's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah building is at that distance, the air blast from an anvil bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussant's damage indicates contact explosives placed directly on the beams. Even more perplexing is the total collapse of column B3, which caused the floors on the east side to pancake onto one another. The building was gutted to within feet of the other side. Column B4, closer to the truck bomb, is completely intact. Yet we are supposed to believe that a blast wave traveled through B4, leaving the sheetrock almost untouched, and completely destroyed the column farther away. And most of the front columns were destroyed when the supporting header beam failed. But the cause of failure, supposedly being air blast, should have thrown it into the building. Instead, it fell straight down and rolled towards the crater. General Parton's report was conclusive. The Murrah Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives carefully placed at four critical junctures on supporting columns within the building.
How many times can we buy the noble lie? Retired United States Air Force Brigadier General Benton K. Parton served as the commander of the Air Force Armament Technology Laboratory and had a collective 25 years of design and testing experience handling explosives and ballistic weapons. Parton sent letters addressed to members of Congress and would later prepare an official report on the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building dated July 30, 1995, submitting it to the U.S. Congress, making it a matter of the congressional public record. He wrote in the report, "When I first saw the picture of the truck bomb's asymmetrical damage to the federal building in Oklahoma, my immediate reaction was that the pattern of damage would have been technically impossible without supplementary demolition charges at some of the reinforced concrete bases inside the building, a standard demolition technique. For a simplistic blast truck bomb of the size and composition reported to be able to reach out on the order of 60 feet and collapse a reinforced column base the size of column A7 is beyond credulity. The total incompatibility with a single truck bomb lies in the fact that either some columns collapsed that should not have collapsed, or some of the columns are still standing that should have collapsed and did not. Reinforced concrete's targets in large buildings are hard targets to blast. I know of no way possible to reproduce the apparent building damage through simply a truck bomb effort. It is easy to determine whether a column was failed by contact demolition charges or by blast loading, such as a truck bomb. It is also easy to cover up crucial evidence, as was apparently done in Waco. I understand that the building is to be demolished by May 23rd or 24th. Why the rush to destroy the evidence? His conclusion, as stated in the report, would read, "The Murrah Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives, carefully placed at four critical junctures on supporting columns within the building. The only possible reinforced concrete structural failure, solely attributable to the truck bomb, was the stripping out of the ceilings of the first and second floors in the pit area behind columns B4 and B5. Even this may have been caused by a demolition charge at column B3. It is truly unfortunate that a separate and independent bomb damage assessment was not made during the cleanup before the building was demolished on May 23rd, and hundreds of truckloads of debris were hauled away, smashed down, and covered with dirt behind a security fence. All ambiguity with respect to the use of supplementing demolition charges and the type of truck used could be quickly resolved if the FBI were required to release the surveillance camera coverage of this terribly tragic event." In a letter to Senator Trent Lott, he would add to his conclusion that, "It is my hope and request that, as a member of Congress, you will support a congressional investigation to determine the true initiators of this bombing, which could not have occurred the way in which it has been portrayed as having happened. Further, it is requested that you defer action and reserve judgment on so-called anti-terrorism legislation that has serious civil liberties implications and which would not be passed except for the Oklahoma City bombing until the causes of the Oklahoma City disaster are determined by independent investigators." In Episode 9, we see through the noble lie and the carefully arranged cover-up as we make a compelling case against the notion of Timothy McVeigh, lone wolf, white separatist, acting alone, strictly motivated by his supposed radical political ideology. In our previous episode, we laid the groundwork by exposing the inextricable intelligence connections surrounding the untold story of Timothy McVeigh. Today, we complete our investigation by highlighting the conflicting evidence subsequently leading us to a stark reevaluation of exactly how and why this tragic event was allowed to happen, implicating members at the highest levels of the United States government as key perpetrators playing significant roles in the major cover-up underway in the days after the bombing. The show trial for Timothy McVeigh proved to be exactly that, when it would only last 3.5 weeks, rendering the defense counsel unable to present much of the evidence they had been able to put together through a discovery process. Due to the efforts of our current Attorney General Merrick Garland, who at this time was serving the Clinton administration as federal prosecutor, where he supervised the investigation and prosecution of Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols, he pled with the presiding Judge Mache for 4 months straight to put most of the records lead defense attorney Stephen Jones and his defense team had come up with, proving that McVeigh did not act alone, under seal for 7 years. The prosecution would never be made aware of the records or be allowed to present it to the jury. The FBI seemed to put all their effort behind the lone bomber theory, seemingly molding the evidence to fit the outcome. And according to investigator Chris Emery, Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a supervisor at the FBI crime lab, turned whistleblower over the Bureau's handling of the evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing, was forced to resign. He testified in Terry Nichols' trial that fellow FBI chemist had changed his findings and lied under oath after meeting with federal prosecutors. The Office of the Inspector General investigated Whitehurst's charges and issued a report which concluded that the FBI crime lab had improperly identified the characteristics of ANFO, the weight of the bomb, the detonation system, and even what kind of explosive was used. Danny Colson, high-ranking FBI official in charge of the FBI's collection of evidence in regard to the Oklahoma City bombing, even said publicly, "We know there were 24 people that were interviewed by the FBI that said they saw Mr. McVeigh on April 19th with someone else. They had no reason to make it up. They didn't have a dog in the fight. They didn't have any reason to just make something up. They told the agents exactly what they saw, and the agents wrote it down. If only one person had seen it, or two, or three, but 24? 24 people say, yes, I saw him with somebody else. That's pretty powerful. We know within 90 minutes McVeigh was already in custody, but in the immediate wake of the bombing, one of the largest nationwide manhunts in the history of the Bureau was launched in order to find the two men, reported to have rented and driven the Ryder truck to its destination.
What happens next is a conspiracist's dream.
John Doe number two remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous.
But 2 months later, the FBI calls off the search. The official line is, John Doe 2 doesn't exist.
It was just hours after the bombing when the news channel first told you about the possibility that surveillance cameras may have captured the explosion and the killers on tape. Our sources and sources for the LA Times describe what's actually on those tapes. The information shows some huge surprises, the biggest that it may have been John Doe number two, not Timothy McVeigh, who detonated the bomb. Brad Edwards has the latest on the investigation in this exclusive News Channel report.
Our new information comes directly from a source that has seen parts of those surveillance tapes. It also comes from reports now in the Los Angeles Times. But perhaps the biggest surprise is contained in the News Channel's own information.
Timothy McVeigh was not the last person to leave the Ryder truck. In fact, another man sat inside the cab of the truck after McVeigh got out. We believe that man is John Doe number two, a man who, for all we know, is still on the loose, leaving open a vital question. Was it John Doe number two who actually set off the bomb, not Timothy McVeigh, as we've all been led to believe? News Channel 4 has for weeks been demanding copies of the surveillance tapes from the FBI. The federal government so far is dragging its feet. But many people in the investigation have seen the tapes, and now so has a source willing to describe to the News Channel what the tapes show. The LA Times report shows there was a surveillance camera near the corner of 5th and Harvey and another near the corner of 5th and Robinson. Federal investigators recreated the time sequence leading up to the bombing by matching the video and still photos from the surveillance cameras.
Since we can't show you the tape ourselves, we're reenacting what our source says he saw on those tapes.
As witnesses told the News Channel before, the tapes show the Ryder truck parked in front of the Murrah building where we now know the blast went off. As witnesses also told us, the tape showed two men sitting inside the Ryder truck. A man strongly resembling Timothy McVeigh gets out of the driver's side, steps down. He then appears to have dropped something on the step up into the truck. He bends down and appears to pick something up off the step. Then he turns and walks directly across 5th Street toward the Journal Record building. All this time, John Doe number two is still inside the Ryder truck's cab, sitting on the passenger side. Time passes. The surveillance tape is time-lapse photography. Without knowing exactly the time interval between shots, our source can't be sure how long John Doe number two sat in that cab. What was he doing all that time? Then the tape shows John Doe number two getting out of the passenger side of the Ryder truck. Again, the tape shows that a bombing witness accurately described what happened next to News Channel 4.
I was standing in the building, and I looked out the window, and I seen the Ryder's truck, and I seen the man get out of the Ryder's truck.
The tape shows John Doe number two getting out, shutting the passenger side door. He steps toward the front of the truck and is momentarily out of the frame of the surveillance camera. But shortly, he appears back in frame, walking toward the rear of the truck, still on the sidewalk in front of the Murrah building. Again, he turns east toward the front of the truck, looking toward the street. John Doe number two then walks diagonally across 5th Street toward the east, as if heading toward the YMCA or the intersection of 5th and Robinson. He again leaves the frame of the camera. Another camera shooting from another angle clearly shows the actual explosion that destroyed the federal building and killed 169 people.
The FBI would never release the surveillance footage, and multiple sworn affidavits would prove the existence of the tapes, as well as the fact that the cameras had been removed from the scene on the day of the bombing by the FBI, even reportedly calling off rescue efforts so federal agents could remove the evidence. The FBI would later claim that they searched their records for the tapes, but they've conveniently come up missing. could the tapes have unequivocally proven there was more than one bomb responsible for the damage at the Murrow Building? Could the tapes have proven the identity of John Doe 2, as well as implicate him as the main culprit responsible for the detonation of the Ryder truck? According to the LA Times, on the two-year anniversary of the bombing in 1997, over 300 people joined a victim's lawsuit against the government, filing against the BATF, the America's Kids Daycare Center, which was inside the federal building, and ICI Explosives, also naming Tim McVeigh and co-defendant Terry Nichols. The lawsuit put forward claims that the Bureau had prior knowledge of the bombing, and that officials of the daycare center knew about the attack. The ATF was supposed to have been the main target in the bombing, but a witness whose wife worked in the Murrow Building claimed to be friendly with some of the agents that worked there. In an effort to locate his wife, the morning of the bombing, he approached an ATF agent asking what had happened and how he should go about finding his wife. The agent tried to use his two-way radio to no avail and then proceeded to nervously volunteer that the ATF wasn't in the building that day because they had been tipped by their pagers not to come to work due to a bomb threat. Multiple witnesses would also claim seeing bomb squads parked across the street over 2 hours before the blast. Almost none of these eyewitness accounts were called upon to testify in the show trials, and all 24 witness accounts placing John Doe 2 at the scene were called errors of eyewitness identification. How much more witness tampering and evidence of prior knowledge do we need before the abstract official narrative implodes? Ignoring crucial evidence is one thing, but getting a federal judge to seal evidentiary records compiled by the defense team is entirely different. To this day, Terry Nichols insists the FBI was involved in the plot, but we will never get to hear that story thanks to the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, who overturned a judge's ruling in 2009 that would have allowed a Utah attorney named Jesse Trinidou to conduct a videotaped deposition of Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols and death row inmate David Paul Hammer. The story goes that the only people that are allowed to visit Terry Nichols in federal lockup in Florence, Colorado, are immediate family members or legal counsel that were on record before he was sentenced. Luckily for us, Jesse Trinidou had helped Nichols with a couple legal matters before he was sentenced, allowing him to visit Nichols. Jesse went to visit Nichols in order to ask him some of these pertinent questions, but attorney-client privilege would not be granted, placing an FBI minder in the room with them. Nichols told him he was willing to go speak to a grand jury in Denver on the condition he would be allowed to tell all, but that would never happen. The DOJ was uninterested, and as Jesse left the federal penitentiary, Nichols walked back across the yard and was taken into protective custody. My goal was to solely focus on the areas of the case I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, setting aside pure speculation in order to stick to undermining the supposed facts in the case with overwhelming evidence. As we come to a conclusive end to this American nightmare, we owe it to the families affected in this tragedy to mention Kenneth Trinidou and Officer Terrence Yakey, a tale of two suicides. These two individuals serve as the faces of what became the eventual cover-up, proving loose ends were being tied off every direction you faced in the wake of the bombing. A Mother Jones article with the title, In Search of John Doe 2, a story the feds never told about the Oklahoma City bombing. They introduced the concept of potential mistaken identity leading to this tragically unfortunate outcome. Kenny Trinidou was driving a 1986 Chevy pickup when he was pulled over at the Mexican border on his way home to San Diego on June 10, 1995. He was dark-haired, 5 feet 8 inches, and well-muscled, a former athlete who had picked up construction work after he quit robbing banks. His left forearm bore a dragon tattoo. Highway patrol officers ran his license and found that it had been suspended and that he was wanted for parole violations. After 2 months in jail in San Diego, Trinidou was shipped on August 18th to a prison in Oklahoma City for a hearing on the parole violations. The move placed Kenny in close proximity to the most famous federal prisoner in America, In one way or another, it also sealed his fate. A sprawling Great Plains town known for its tornadoes, Oklahoma City was already the center of a swirl of theories about the crime, all of them insisting that the two men could not have acted alone. Some refused to give up on the idea of Middle Eastern terrorists, speculating about a plot headed by Saddam Hussein. Others suspected an inside job by the feds. Some simply stuck to the far more plausible conviction that there were co-conspirators not yet apprehended. After all, immediately following the bombing, law enforcement had been searching furiously for a man whom numerous sources said they saw with McVeigh, and who by some accounts was seen walking away from the Ryder truck. The character whose police composite sketch became known around the world as John Doe No. 2. According to the police description, this man was 5 feet, 9 inches, muscular, dark-haired. By some accounts, he drove an older model pickup truck and had a dragon tattooed on his left forearm. Kenny's brother, Jesse Trinidad, knew nothing about the resemblance between his brother and the nation's most wanted man, but he now believes it sparked the events that would launch him on a 12-year investigation of a prison mystery and a massive government stonewalling effort. In the process, he would discover documents showing that even as the Justice Department was working to convict what it insisted were only two conspirators, its agents were actively investigating a wider plot, a plot whose possible ramifications they concealed from defense lawyers and from a public that at a delicate moment in an election year, they were anxious to reassure. On August 19th, the day after Trinidad was transferred to the DOJ's Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, he allegedly called his brother Jesse, who would later describe Kenneth as sounding chipper in the call. According to District Judge Timothy Leonard, during a check of Kenneth's cell at 2:38 a.m. on August 21st, 1995, all was normal, with no sign of blood or a suicide attempt. Thus, Trinidad's injuries and hanging occurred in quite a short period of time of 24 minutes or less. According to prison records, at 3:02 a.m., in the morning of August 21st, 1995, Kenneth was found dead in his cell, suspended from a noose made out of his bedsheets. Oklahoma County District Attorney Bob Macy and federal officials determined that Trinidad had committed suicide by hanging himself. Investigative journalist James Ridgway wrote that authorities would later put forth an elaborate scenario in which Kenny tried to hang himself but fell, bruising his head and body, and then tried to slit his throat with a toothpaste tube before succeeding in his second hanging attempt. A 2004 article found at The Independent claims when the family received the body from the prison authorities, it was covered in wounds, cuts, and bruises, leading the family to believe Trinidad had been tortured and beaten before his death. Trinidad had sustained 3 heavy blows to the head, and his throat had been cut. Prison authorities claimed the wounds were self-inflicted. Again, based on the Mother Jones article, the day after Trinidad's death, Kevin Rowland, the chief investigator of the Oklahoma State Medical Examiner, filed a complaint with the FBI reporting irregularities in the investigation of Trinidad's death. The coroner was at first not permitted into the cell where Trinidad had died, and the cell itself was washed out by the afternoon of August 21, 1995, before the legally required investigation could be performed. The complaint went on to state that, although the exact cause of death could not be determined, the claim that Trinidad had committed suicide was not consistent with the medical examiner's findings, and Trinidad appeared to have been tortured. The FBI paperwork from the agent who received the medical examiner's calls reads murder and believes that foul play is suspected in this matter. Kenneth's brother Jesse was an attorney and began gathering information on his brother's death, still with no knowledge of a possible connection to the Oklahoma City bombing. An anonymous caller in 1996 would vaguely tell Jesse that his brother had been killed in a botched interrogation gone wrong, mentioning that Kenneth fit a profile. And after an Oklahoma City reporter named J.D. Cash, who had been investigating the bombing himself and had become very skeptical of the mainstream narrative, reached out in an effort to convince Jesse that his brother was mistaken for a known associate of Timothy McVeigh's by the name of Richard Lee Guthrie, a member of the Aryan Republican Army, a white supremacist group later exposed as being a potential FBI front group from a FOIA request obtaining an email from former FBI agent Don Jarrett, who investigated right-wing terrorism in the 1990s. Trinidad and Guthrie shared a strong physical resemblance. They were the same height, weight, and muscular build. Both had dark hair and thick mustaches. Both had dragon tattoos on their left arm, and both are thought to have resembled the description of John Doe No. 2. After being shown a picture of Kenneth Trinidad, Timothy McVeigh is reported to have said, quote, "Now I know why Trinidad was killed, because they thought he was Richard Guthrie." Less than 1 year after Trinidad's death, Guthrie would also be found dead in his prison cell. The day before he was scheduled to give a television interview, his death would also be ruled a suicide by hanging. Our final story is proof positive of a major cover-up at the level of local law enforcement, condemning the leadership in the Oklahoma City Police Department for shielding the public from the truth in this case, while protecting federal government corruption, including state-sponsored terrorism. The story of Officer Terrence Yakey is one that resonated with me above all others. Hero cop and first officer on the scene, only minutes after the bombing, courageously rushing into what was left of the Murrow Building and spending over 3.5 hours pulling victims from the rubble, ultimately being responsible for saving at least 8 lives. He would receive multiple awards for his heroic actions in the wake of the bombing, including being awarded the key to the city of El Reno, Oklahoma. But reportedly, he was reluctant to embrace the moniker of hero. According to an article originally published in the Washington Weekly, April 21, 1997, quote, "He kept telling me it wasn't what I thought it was," said his ex-wife, Tanya Rivera, "that they were only choosing officers who were not even at the site, you know, who didn't see anything, to take public rewards, recognition, that sort of stuff. They started pressuring them into taking the rewards," added Rivera. "There came a time about mid-year where they were forcing him into going to these award ceremonies. As in, yes, you could not go, but we'll make your life hell." The story of the reluctant hero, she added, was nothing more than a real thin veil of truth which covered up a mountain of deceit. Terry wanted no part of it, his sister Vicky Jones agreed. Terry hated that stuff. "I'm no hero," he would say. "Nobody that had anything to do with helping those people in that bombing are heroes." Why would the Medal of Valor recipient make such a bizarre-sounding statement? In a letter he wrote to a bombing victim and friend, the officer tells the real reason for his reluctance to be honored as a hero. "Dear Ramona, I hope that whatever you hear now and in the future will not change your opinions of myself or others with the Oklahoma City Police Department, although some of the things I'm about to tell you are very disturbing. I don't know if you recall everything that happened that morning or not, so I'm not sure if you know what I'm referring to. The man that you and I were talking about in the pictures, I have made the mistake of asking too many questions as to his role in the bombing and was told to back off. I was told by several officers he was an ATF agent who was overseeing the bombing plot, and at the time the photos were taken, he was calling in his report of what had just went down. I think my days as a police officer are numbered because of the way my supervisors are acting. There's a lot of secrets floating around now about my mental state of mind. I think they're going to write me up because of my ex-wife and a VPO. I told you about talking to Chaplain Poe. Well, the bastard wrote me up in a report stating I should be relieved of my duties. I made the mistake of thinking that a person's conversation with the chaplain was private, which, by the way, might have cost me my job as a police officer. A friend at headquarters told me that Poe sent out letters to everyone in the department. That bitch Joanne Randall I told you about is up to something. And I think it has something to do with Poe. If she gets her way, they will tar and feather me. I was told that Jack Poe has written up a report on every single officer that has been in to see him, including Gordon Martin and John Avery. Knowing what I know now, and understanding fully just what went down that morning, makes me ashamed to wear a badge from Oklahoma City's police department. I took an oath to uphold the law and to enforce the law to the best of my ability. This is something I cannot honestly do and hold my head up proud any longer if I keep my silence as I am ordered to do. There are several others out there who saw what we saw, and even some who played a role in what happened that day. 2 pages missing. My guess is, the more time an officer has to think about the screw-up, the more he's going to question what happened. Can you imagine what would be coming down now if that had been our officers who had let this happen? Because it was the feds that did this, and not the locals, is the reason it's okay. You were right all along. I'm truly sorry I doubted you and your motives about recording history. You should know, it is going to be one hell of a fight. Everyone was behind you until you started asking questions, as I did, as to how many federal agents arrived at the scene at the same time. Luke Franey, a BATF agent who claimed he was in the building, was not in the building at the time of the blast. I know this for a fact. I saw him. I also saw full riot gear worn with rifles in hand. Why? Don't make the mistake as I did and ask the wrong people. I worry about you and your young family, because of some of the statements that have been made towards me, a police officer. Whatever you do, don't confront McPherson with the bomb squad about what I told you. His actions and defensiveness towards the bombing would make any normal person think he was defending himself, as if he drove the damn truck up to the building himself. I'm not worried for myself, but for you and your group. I would not be afraid to say at this time that you and your family could be harmed if you get any closer to the truth. At this time, I think for your well-being, it is best for you to distance yourself and others from those of us who have stirred up too many questions about the altering and falsifying of the federal investigation's reports. I truly believe there are other officers like me out there who would not settle for anything but the truth. It is just a matter of finding them. The only true problem, as I see it, is who do we turn to then? It is vital that people like you, Eddie Smith, and others keep asking questions and demanding answers for the actions of our federal government and law enforcement agencies that knew beforehand and participated in the cover-up. The sad truth of the matter is that they have so many police officers convinced that by covering up the truth about the operation gone wrong, that they are actually doing our citizens a favor. What I want to know is how many other operations have they had that blew up in their faces? Makes you stop and take another look at Waco. I would consider it to be an insult to my profession as a police officer and to the citizens of Oklahoma for any of the city, state, or federal agents that stood by and let this happen to be recognized as anything other than their part in participation in letting this happen. For those who ran from the scene to change their attire to hide the fact that they were there should be judged as cowards. If our history books and records are ever truly corrected about that day, it will show this, and maybe even some lame excuse as to why it happened, but I truly don't believe it will from what I now know to be the truth. Even if I tried to explain it to you, the way it was explained to me, and the ridiculous reason for having our own police departments falsify reports to their fellow officers, to the citizens of the city, and to our country, you would understand why I feel the way I do about all of this. I believe that a lot of the problems the officers are having right now are because some of them know what really happened and can't deal with it. And others like myself made the mistake of trusting the one person we were supposed to be able to turn to, only to be stabbed in the back. I'm sad to say that I believe my days as a police officer are numbered because of all of this. Shortly after the bombing, Yakey appeared at his ex-wife's. About 2 weeks before his death, he'd come into my house at strange times, said Rivera. 2:30 in the morning, 4 in the morning, unannounced, trying to give me life insurance policies. He kept telling me we needed to get remarried immediately, or me and the girls would not be taken care of. I mean, why would a guy tell you to take a life insurance policy, knowing damn well it wouldn't pay for a suicide? He obviously knew he was in danger. Yet Officer Terrence Yakey was not the type of person to easily show his feelings. He didn't want to tell his family anything that might get them hurt. He told me enough to let me know that it was not what they were making it out to be, said Rivera, and that he was disgusted and didn't want any part of it, but he never went into detail. It scared me. On May 8, 1996, 3 days before Sergeant Terrence Yakey was to receive the Oklahoma Police Department's Medal of Valor, he was found dead in a field in El Reno, Oklahoma. A Canadian County Deputy Sheriff named Mike Ramsey discovered Yakey's abandoned car. It was filled with blood. He immediately called a homicide investigator and taped off the crime scene. Although the scene was technically in the jurisdiction of the El Reno Police Department, the Oklahoma City Police Chief would fly a helicopter down to El Reno and take control of the crime scene. It wouldn't be until several hours after the vehicle was found that police dogs located Yakey's body in a ditch about a mile and a half away from the car, with no firearm found. Both of his wrists had been slashed in numerous places. His throat had been cut from ear to ear, and he had reportedly lost about 2 pints of blood before getting out of his car, locking it, and proceeded to walk a mile and a half over rough terrain, crawling under a barbed wire fence, wading through a culvert, and then lay down in a ditch, deciding that that was the right moment to shoot himself in the head at a very uncomfortable angle for a self-inflicted gunshot. The Oklahoma City Police Department would suspiciously rule his death a suicide, despite not having a suicide note or a suicide weapon, or grappling with the fact that he also had handcuff marks on his wrists, as well as rope burns on his body, complete with grass in his wounds, indicating his body potentially being dragged to the final location. No autopsy would be performed on Terry Yakey's body. When his car was discovered locked up and filled with his own blood, it was also in very unusual condition. The seats had been completely unbolted. The floorboards had been ripped up. The side panels had been removed. And it looked very much as if whoever did that to the car was searching for something. According to an article by Pat Shannon, the morning of the bombing, Terry was very upset. He reportedly called his ex-wife crying and saying repeatedly, "It's not true. It's not what they are saying. It didn't happen that way." In an interview with Tanya Yakey after his death, she revealed that Terry had been very upset by something he had seen under the daycare center on April 19th. He had wanted to go back and photograph it, but the officials would not let him onto the site again. The Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee speculates that what Terry saw may have coincided with the possible evidence of another unreported bombing device uncovered. Sergeant Yakey had told friends that he was going out of town to hide or secure evidence of a cover-up of the bombing by federal agents. It was his day off, and he was traveling in his private automobile. In his last known conversation, Terry reportedly told a friend that he was being followed by the feds and had to shake them. Previously, his household had been subjected to numerous threatening phone calls by persons unknown, threats which have not ceased even after his death. Tanya Yakey has moved 5 times in 3 years since the Oklahoma City tragedy. She continues to get intimidating letters and threatening phone calls. Since her husband's death, Her home has been broken into, and personal threats have been written on her living room walls. She remains in fear for her life, constantly seeking asylum, with no place to turn. In our effort to return from this upside-down world we seem to permanently reside in, I ask you to reflect on the morality of the state. How can we continue to buy the noble lie?